I didn't particularly want to do a story about abortion and the murder of Dr. Tiller, the late-term abortion provider who was murdered by a pro-life anti-abortion extremist. I had become uneasy about late-term abortions, abortions where the baby was viable and able to live outside the womb. But as I started to do my research, I was moved by the passionate advocacy of Dr. Tiller, who knew he would be properly murdered one day, and the button he always wore that said simply, "Trust women." And when I read about the reasons women turned to him as a last resort, I grew more and more interested, and ultimately transformed by the poignancy and critical need of women in the late stage of their pregnancies. And then, as if I had been totally cut off from my own history, I remembered my own feelings of regret and shame about my own abortion when I was young, before abortion was legal. And I realized I was drawn to do this story. In a recent Gallup poll prior to the murder of Dr. Tiller, a majority of Americans, 51%, now call themselves pro-life. 42% identify as pro-choice. When the same poll was taken only 1 year ago, it was nearly the reverse. One poll, of course, doesn't make a new reality, but over 80% of the counties in the United States do not have an abortion provider. How has this happened? Some feminists have said that there has been a backlash or pushback against women and their allies because pro-choice women have actually won the debate about whether children deserve to be planned and wanted. Over 90% of Americans of childbearing age use birth control, and abortion has been legal since 1973. Our guest today has another idea about why pro-choice attitudes have been losing social support. She suggests we have to look at the social context of women having abortions. Her name is Jennifer Baumgardner. Usually described as a third-wave feminist, Jennifer is an author, lecturer, activist, and prominent spokeswoman for women and girls. Her newest book is Abortion and Life. She is in her late 30s and has a young son. Welcome to our show, Jennifer.
Thank you.
In the early years of your writing career, in the 1990s, I believe, you wrote that young feminists had different feelings about abortion than their elders being the women who had forged the women's liberation movement of the 60s and 70s. Can you tell us about what that difference was then?
Yeah, the women who forged the women's liberation movement of the 60s and 70s were agitating in the context of legal or illegal. If you had an unplanned pregnancy, were you going to risk your life and pay extortion-level prices and have absolutely no recourse if something went wrong in order to have an abortion, or was it going to be legal? That's a dramatically different context than I was raised in. I'm 39. I was 2.5 when Roe v. Wade was handed down, making abortion legal in all 50 states. So my generation and people younger than me were raised with legal abortion. So the question wasn't legal or illegal, even though I feel like it was presented that way. The activism was always presented that way, but that wasn't the reality, and we didn't grow up experiencing it as legal or illegal. We grew up experiencing it as legal until when? Legal, but for whom? So what's going on now and what has been going on for the last 36 years, it's primarily a question of access. So all of the people who are most vulnerable in society, so young people, people who are not of age yet, young girls, poor people, people who have limited access to health care, they are the people who are vulnerable in this issue. Women who are empowered because of their age, financially, where they live, and access to health care, they actually are not having problems accessing abortion. Again, I feel like all of this should make us be describing our abortion activism differently or our orientation toward abortion differently. I'm always surprised by the surprise when people say, oh, now it's 51% say that they identify as pro-life, and that's so bad. I don't see it exactly that way. I acknowledge 30-odd years of a very organized pro-life movement that has various wings. I mean, from, an ethical wing that I can get something from to an extremist wing that has to do with white supremacy and anti-government factions. And I'm assuming, yes, those are the people that are murdering doctors, very fringe elements of this pro-life movement, as opposed to the vast majority of the pro-life movement or the vast majority of people who would identify as pro-life. But I have been traveling around the country with Amy Richards, my writing partner, on several projects, several books, and my friend. And we're constantly intrigued by how people, when given the opportunity just to describe themselves, how often they use the term pro-life. They aren't people who want to overturn Roe v. Wade, usually. In fact, are usually not people who want to make that decision on behalf of someone else. But the term pro-life sounds to them more descriptive of their value system than the term pro-choice. And a long time ago, I guess I thought, rather than lament that, I would just try to understand it. Rather than try to nag people into using the language I had been raised with, why not try to understand or find different ways to communicate that go beyond these terms? So I think that when we hear that 51% of the U.S. is now identifies as pro-life, we aren't hearing that 51% want to outlaw abortion. And in fact, when you ask the question, would you be in favor of overturning Roe, the numbers become much lower.
Can you tell us how many women have abortions in our country today?
Yeah. It had been for a long time about 1.3 million women each year in the U.S. had an abortion. Now it's more closer to 1.15 or 1.2. So the abortion rate has been coming down a little bit. It might spike again because of the economy, lack of access to health care. There are a lot of things that make the abortion rate go up.
Do you know what percentage of women that constitutes the 1.13 or 1.5 million?
Well, I don't know exactly what that constitutes annually, but I do know that something like 42 or 43% of women in the U.S. will have an abortion in her lifetime. And of that amount, so that's almost half, of that amount of women, the majority of them will have more than one. So having multiple abortions, meaning two or more, is actually very, very common because getting pregnant is very, very easy. If you're having intercourse, heterosexual intercourse, and you're ovulating, even if you're using birth control, things go wrong, and people who are fertile can have multiple pregnancies that they don't want.
The theme of your latest book, Abortion and Life, you describe how abortion has become an issue rather than a part of a woman's life. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. I think that the way we've come, as people who support abortion rights, so that's me and you, the way that we have come to talk about that is very political in a way that I think is somewhat empty. It's about policing language. It's about bumper sticker slogans, keep your laws off my body. And it takes the person in her actual life or his or her actual life out of the equation. In fact, when you ask people about their actual lives, you learn that people have all of these dramatic stories that have to do with what it means to have a reproductive system. But we've gotten so far away from that. It's, are you pro-choice or are you pro-life? Do you believe abortion on demand without apology? And, you know, all these different levels of supposedly being evolved on that issue. I have come to believe that the most courageous and the most pro-abortion rights thing you can do is tell the truth about your experiences. And you were saying you had some ambivalence or negative feelings about your abortion experience. That is valuable information for us to have as people who support abortion rights, whether it's because it can tell us a little bit about emotionally what is that experience or what was it for you personally, but maybe then for someone of your era, what needs to happen so that on a medical or clinical level, the abortion experience is handled better, because there's still room for improvement there. I mean, doctors like Tiller and people who are abortion providers whom I know personally, they are doing such incredible work, but there is always room for improvement with something that is so emotionally laden and so wrapped up in profound decisions about who we are as people, as abortion is. So I think that providing space for people to just tell the truth about what's happened to them is probably the most political thing you could possibly do right now around abortion.
And why do you think it's so difficult?
You have an unplanned pregnancy, you decide you need an abortion, you go in and you have that experience, and the message that you get from society, or your fear at least, no one ever wants to hear about this. There's no one you can talk to about this. It's not for polite conversation. If you brought it up to your mother, she might cry. If you brought it up to your new boyfriend, he might break up with you. You know, there's this fear that everybody, even though it's incredibly common, and it's more likely that someone would say, oh, I have that experience too, there's this paralyzing fear. It's going to either make people uncomfortable or it's going to let people know what a bad person you are. So that's the dominant vibe around talking honestly about abortion in the U.S. And then separate of that, there's this profound isolation of providers. Like, the clinics are way far outside of town and they're in bunkers, you know, and they aren't integrated into the downtown of a flourishing small town or flourishing small city. The doctors are treated like total pariahs. So separate of their security issues, their colleagues don't treat them like medical professionals. They're isolated. Nurses, you know, you name it. I mean, the level of professional disrespect afforded to abortion doctors is astounding. And my dad's a doctor in Fargo, North Dakota, and we have a really nice abortion clinic in the town. It's the only one in the state. And I know that he's really appalled by how abortion doctors are treated, and yet I think he feels sort of confused himself about what he could do to interrupt it. So even though I do think that doctors and nurses and medical professionals are contributing to this profound isolation that breeds violence and makes the women themselves feel ashamed and like sends this message, certainly never talk about this, it's shameful, I think that they're at a loss about how to change that reality and how to interrupt it. And so I do, as an activist, I try to ask myself, okay, well, what do I think you can do to interrupt it? I think it starts with really small things, signaling that you are a safe person to talk to. And again, not because you're yelling your politics all over the place, because that actually, I think, can be alienating, but because, you know, meaning the bumper sticker level of politics, but by saying, as a doctor, I'm speaking now, if I could tell my dad what to say, as a doctor, I feel really bad and really at a loss that my colleagues who perform abortions are isolated, and I'm going to reach out to them, or I'm going to write a note saying, what is it that I could do that would make you feel more supported? Just that little gesture could, again, have these profound implications, I think, on this issue.
Do you think also the polarization of the debate and the politics around that makes it really hard for women to talk to their friends who are also perhaps...
Yeah, because if they have ambivalent feelings about their abortion, then does that mean they're actually pro-life? You know, I think the fact that it's so polarized and made to be so black and white makes it so that the complexity of our human experiences is too complicated for the way this issue is framed. So if you're you and you're talking about any ambivalence about late-term abortion, is that just too dangerous to talk about, given how pro-life movement forces have really mobilized against later-term abortions? You might say, yeah, I think it is. You know, and so, yes, I feel like the polarization is very anti-honesty and very anti-woman and ultimately very anti-abortion.
In your book, you have told the stories of women who have had abortions. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us some stories about women who have had late-term abortions?
Yeah, one woman who's jumping into my head right now was pregnant with twins, and she knew she had a heart condition. I think she thought she had a heart murmur. She knew that she had some sort of heart condition, but she wasn't sickly. And when she found out she was pregnant with twins, her doctor said, and she wanted to sustain the pregnancy, her doctor said at a certain point, you will not survive this pregnancy. Your babies might survive, but if they survive, they won't have you. You know, they won't have a mother. Does that sound like something you think you can hang with, or should you terminate this pregnancy? And it was pretty late when she got this diagnosis. It was going to be a late-term procedure. And she thought about it a lot. And there was a part of her that thought, well, you know, there's maybe this 1% chance that I could live, but I would be probably really disabled from my heart condition, or my children could never know their mom, and they could be with their father, and the father was someone she wasn't married to, but, you know, was in a relationship with, but he was sort of unstable and a rock musician. And she made this really difficult decision to sacrifice this pregnancy that she felt very emotionally invested in so that she could live, and so that her children wouldn't be raised in this way that she had absolutely no control over, too. No participation in, no sense, no reason to believe that the boyfriend could handle it. She feels like it was the right decision, but it was incredibly difficult. Mm-hmm. And it certainly haunts her to this day. And then in New York City, later term, by which I mean 18 to 24 weeks, I'm saying, abortions that take a little bit longer to do, like 1 or 2 days, 2 or 3 days rather, because you need to dilate in order to do the procedure, the women that I've met who are doing those, almost all of the women I've met, it was because they didn't have access to health care earlier on. If they had had health insurance or regularly saw doctors or had easy access to birth control, the pregnancy probably wouldn't have happened, much less the inability to deal with it because, I don't have $300 for this abortion or $400 for this abortion, and then, you know, keep trying to raise the money each week. The abortion's getting a little more expensive and a little more serious. And by the time they show up in New York City to have their later-term procedure, the abortion's going to cost, you know, more than $2,000 and take 2 or 3 days. And so I've definitely seen the way restrictions and a particularly lack of access to health care pushes women to have later-term abortions. So my queasiness about later-term abortion doesn't have to do, I acknowledge it's a more developed fetus or baby. I fully acknowledge that and think about that a lot. But my queasiness around it has more to do with the fact that some of them, maybe a majority of them, if it's not something where a fetal anomaly was detected, could happen a lot earlier.
So let's talk about these early restrictions that push women towards late-term abortions.
Well, the early restrictions that push women toward later-term abortion have to do with how few states allow Medicaid to pay for abortions, and then have to do with all of the parental consent laws that we have. And in the case of the Medicaid abortions, I think that's purely punitive. I don't think it's justifiable in any way. In terms of parental consent laws, meaning where minors have to have one or both parents sign off on saying it's okay for them to have an abortion, I do think that's very, very punitive, but I think it's coming maybe from attempting to be from a good place of we want our daughters, when they're in crisis, and an unplanned pregnancy is a crisis, we want them to be able to get all the support they need, and unless they have a very terrible relationship or an unsafe relationship with their parents are their primary support, usually. So we want that relationship to be in play to support the girl as she's going through this. First of all, most minor girls do engage their parents in these decisions. It's something like 90% of abortions performed on minors, the parents are involved. But for that 10% where that's not the case, I don't think having a law in place is going to change that picture at all. Again, it's all these other hoops you're going to have to jump through. It can push back in a dangerous way the timing of the abortion. And in general, just makes what is already a stressful and crisis situation that much more stressful.
You have said, I believe, that you have been transformed by your research in this area. Can you tell us about that?
Mm-hmm. I was raised, really happily raised, blithely supporting abortion rights and feeling really proud of that, feeling proud that my family in Fargo, which is a more quiet and probably more politically conservative part of the country, that we were confident about our beliefs in that regard. It was an issue that spoke to me at a young age. I think I did sense that a woman's ability to make decisions about her life was really tied to the Supreme Court decision and to abortion's legality. And that was really exhilarating to me. And so I felt very connected to the issue at a really young age, like even 8 or 9 years old. But I wouldn't say I totally understood the issue. I think I absorbed what women I respected said about it, who were much older than me, and what activists or public figures said about it, be they politicians or the head of Planned Parenthood. And what they tended to say was, keep your laws off my body. It's not a baby, it's a fetus. You know, it's her decision, not the baby's, or not the fetus. You know, it's the woman versus the fetus, you know, and pro-life people are pronatalists, you know, they hate women. And I also had learned from women I respected that the reaction to an abortion is relief. It's not sadness. It's not a mixture of emotions. It's relief. And that really made sense to me. And so I kind of just accepted that without having talked to too many people about their abortions. Mm-hmm. Once I started talking to hundreds of people about their abortions, I heard relief mixed in there all the time, particularly right after the procedure was over. Like, oof, okay, I made this decision. Now it's over. And I can just try to get my life back or, you know, move on. But I didn't just hear relief, and I didn't even primarily hear relief. And that was a total revelation to me, that people could have complicated emotional reactions to this experience and still not want abortion to be overturned. And I think I'd had this fear that if it wasn't this, like, really clear thing that you felt great about afterwards, then maybe abortion rights weren't valid, you know, or strong mm-hmm. enough. But in fact, I think the complexity and the full range of emotions is part of what gives it its moral authority. I think women and men make those decisions in a context of a whole life of, you know, who they think they are, how they always perceive themselves, what they want for their future, what's going on in their relationship right that minute, their family of origin and what they might think or what they've been taught, their religion. All these really deep life and death questions come up in that decision, whether or not to terminate or to continue a pregnancy. And I just developed a lot of respect for it.
Is there anything else you might like to tell our audience before we go?
For activists and legislators who have a stake in this, in maintaining the legality of abortion, I think if you don't place yourself in there personally, you're being kind of a coward. So I haven't personally had an abortion, so I have to be honest about that. I talk about my unplanned pregnancies, and I talk about what my experience with abortion has been, which is helping my sister have her procedure when she was 15 and helping a lot of people actually have procedures. I wish there was someone in the Senate or Congress who would say, I had an abortion, a woman or a guy. mm-hmm. There's a lot more men in Congress to say, yeah, I've been part of an abortion. But these people who have so much control over deciding this on behalf of other people, they don't place themselves in it. And I actually do think that that's very ethically suspect. I guess my biggest thing is, if you can be an ally, that there are little things you can do all the time to interrupt the isolation that both women and providers feel. Mm-hmm. And I think it is as simple as writing a note to the clinic in your town and saying, I just want you to know that I support you privately and I could support you publicly. If there's something I can do that would be helpful, please let me know because I do want to do it. And just acknowledging in a humble way that often we are at a loss of knowing what to do in these situations and inviting people to offer some suggestions of what we can do. And then certainly as a friend that will listen to somebody tell their story about what has happened to them, I think that's probably something I really, really advocate at this point.
Well, Jennifer, I want to thank you so much. I wish more people would speak about the abortion issue the way you do.
Well, thank you.